Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art Beats and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Want to get a little more from every sip? Smartwater Alkaline doesn't just taste crisp and pure. It's loaded with everything you need to perform at your best, whether you're running marathons or boardroom meetings. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.
I got a phone call. I was just at my desk on the dignity of a desk treadmill that I was very excited about trying out and looking at my latest research on televangelists. And I got this phone call from a very bored physician's assistant who said that I had stage 4 cancer and that I would have to come to the hospital right away.
Duke University religion professor Kate Bowler was 35 and living with her husband and 2-year-old son in Durham, North Carolina, when she started feeling pain in her stomach. She was eventually sent in for a CT scan and got the results by phone the next day.
And it sounded like I was underwater. Like, I could tell that she was talking, but your brain just kind of becomes this sort of quiet sort of screaming in the background. And at some point she stopped talking, and all I could think of to say was, but I have a son. As if my best argument, my biggest love would be enough to like create a wall between the information she was going to try to give me that would absolutely shatter my world.
Did she answer you?
I remember she just said, she just kind of flatly repeated, I'm going to need for you to come inside. Because my office was only about a 5-minute walk from the intake, from the ER, from where I would just have to go and then go through the intake process and take off my blazer. And I mean, I had just given a lecture. Like, it was just like, it was like taking off the whole career that I had just had and then put on a hospital gown. I remember with each person that I loved, like the feeling of this, like as if touching them and it shattering, like the look on my husband's face, and he just looked like he was an astronaut that whose cord had been cut and he was just floating away. And like the panic in my mom's voice, where she all of a sudden, you could tell she was just like scrambling to figure out who would take my son. Like, it's just, and I had to be like, oh mom, like don't worry, like my husband, like Tobin, he'll keep living. But that everybody in that moment is just, it's like watching the glass crack under our feet. But I think the thing that was so painful about it was it felt like I was breaking them. Like, that's what love does, is it just, it's not just the thing that holds us, but it felt like it was the anvil you kind of drop on them.
Kate Bowler was brought into a 4-hour emergency surgery at Duke Hospital that night to remove a large tumor in her colon. How long after surgery did you hear, when you hear stage 4 cancer, when did it sink in how serious all was?
I didn't know that. I honestly didn't know. I mean, maybe I just wasn't. I understood there was cancer in the world. It seemed to me that it's like with burns, degrees of burns. I knew it existed. I didn't know what it meant. And so all of the words they were using really didn't make any sense to me. I didn't know if stage four was the worst one. I didn't know what lesions meant. I didn't know they were talking about tumors. I understood vaguely that I was some kind of spaghetti bowl of cancer, but I couldn't figure out where it had spread. And the truth is, at the beginning, neither did they, because it's really only later you do all these sort of evaluative scans. And so the first moment of clarity I had was with a resident, like a junior resident who was stuck checking on me in the middle of the night, and no one was in the room, and I just cleared my throat and asked. And I was like, "Hi, I'm sorry, but nobody has told me yet, like, if I'm gonna live. And I wondered if you could answer some of my questions." And it was one of the most unbelievably intimate conversations of my life, because he wasn't ready to have that conversation, and neither was I.
And what did he tell you?
He did something that I've come to recognize as like the most common response to like a really, really hard question, which is a series of abstractions that attempt precision. So he said, "Well, I can't answer that except by telling you the median survival rate for people with your diagnosis," you know, which is probably not a bad attempt. But people who normally had colon cancer, which I didn't know, are in their 70s and 80s. And people don't normally have it when they're 35. And when I finally just kept asking questions, and he said, "Well, you likely have a 14% chance of survival." And then he got up to leave. It was only by the time he got to the door that I was like, wait, what does survival mean? Like, realizing that he probably had a number in his head. And he's like, that means 2 years. And so it was so precise. It was so measured that somewhere in the abstraction, it was almost impossible for me to figure out like what that meant for my life, my time,
So he was saying you have a 14% chance of living for 2 years.
Yeah. Based on what normally 70-year-old men have. So it always felt like I was like stuck in a word problem. Like, mm-hmm. Kate has, you know, like, two trains are coming. Like, one goes 55 miles per hour. And it's one of the weirdest things I think about being a patient is you have this individual case, and then you're all of a sudden in a set of probabilities and systems that you don't really understand. Like a group of doctors will come into the room, but you don't know what their jobs are. And other people do, and it's mostly based on the length of their coat. But you don't know that. Like, you just got there, and you're scared out of your mind.
Yeah.
Mostly, I just understood that I probably wouldn't live through the year, and it was fall. And something about it being fall, and it being the last fall, and then the Christmas, and it being the last Christmas, it felt like I was holding, like, an impossible thought. Like, every time I tried to think my way around it, it was too big or too heavy.
Kate Bowler was surrounded by people who had a lot of experience thinking about these things. Her colleagues at Duke's Divinity School.
So I work in this hilariously, wonderfully geriatric profession where almost all my friends on faculty were in the 65-plus category. And my favorite were in the 70-plus category. So they were always the best people to talk to, because they were the people to say, "Hey, like, I'm 35. I don't think I'm going to make it to 36. I'm absolutely terrified of what happens when my child can't remember me, and that I will be the worst thing that happens to all the people that I love. Like, period. Those are all my deepest fears. Like, how do I live? Like, what do I need to do? How can I, like, wrap this up? Like, help me stick the landing on this thing." And these are people who, like, have done a million weddings, but a million funerals for the most unspeakable things. And they'd lived a lot of life, and then also had it blow up in their faces. And I just remember my friends saying, "Oh, Kate, like, you can want it to all add up, but, like, it will come undone. And when they said it, I believed them.
She's written about the father of one of her students, who found out he only had a few months to live. She writes, his father didn't have a wish list. In fact, his father didn't wish for anything at all. Not a trip, not a meal. He sat contentedly in his overstuffed recliner in the living room, humming about how much he loved his family. I'm Phoebe Judge, and this is Love. Kate Bowler grew up in Manitoba, Canada, as she says, in the prairies. Her mother and father were both college professors, and she was raised in a religious home as a Mennonite.
Mennonites are like this, they're kind of like cousins to the Amish, and to they're a group. They're like, you can only think of them in mass, and they're always, you know, they're famous for things like pacifism and simplicity and mostly just, I don't know, ruining everything with Jell-O. But they have this wonderful theology of exhausting martyrdom. Like, they totally expect life to be the worst. And I didn't realize what an advantage that would be to be around a group like that when your life is exploding. Because they don't have sort of wildly inflated, optimistic expectations. But they're great. They're great at suffering. They're great at errands. They're great at being like, huh, this fence is leaning a little bit. We might, they're great at scaling recipes by about 200 or 300. And so you kind of, they kind of bring the hive feeling. And that was such a gift just to create like momentum. And I think that was so good for, I mean, for me, it was this, the strongest feeling I wanted to have was that my husband and my son, because we live in Durham, North Carolina, without any family nearby, that they could be kind of brought back into the web of people. And that what I was picturing was, okay, well, these will be the people that will carry them when I'm gone. And so they need to kind of like glue together now. So I guess one of the first things I did as a cancer mom was I let everybody take care of my kid, even though I wanted all the time. But I was like, okay, now is time for us all to be a group project. And Mennonites are so good at that.
What was the hardest time of the day for you?
Well,
you know, there's funny thing yes. where people say when they wake up in the middle of the night. I just saw this New Yorker cartoon, this Roz Chast, who said that, you know, when you wake up in the middle, there are these four categories that keep you up, you know, am I going to be fired? Am I going to be audited? What cancer do I have? And you know, there's this joke. People will wake up. Well, I was just considering all the types of cancers that I probably have coursing through my body in the middle of the night. When these are people who are perfectly healthy, when you have the worst form of cancer, you can. What does someone like you do when they wake up in the middle of the night?
Oh man, 2 a.m. Kate is like, it kind of reminds me of like after philosophy classes in college, Kate, where you're just like deeply horrifyingly existential and emotional all the time. But I did, the worst moments were the overwhelming fears of, I mean, it's the truth of it, which is that nothing will add up to enough. It's like, you look, you can just feel the tick of it. And I was honest about that at 2 a.m. in a way that I wasn't at 2 p.m. 2 p.m., I was regular hyper-efficiency super monster Kate, who just like had stuff to get done and was trying to make sure everyone had enough towels. It was in the 2 a.m. kind of moments where I could be the most honest about the fact that that this was not the life that I hoped for, that I felt robbed, that everyone else that I loved was being robbed. And also that this whole experience might end up so badly that it wouldn't just take me down, but that, I mean, our rising medical costs, that like all the debt of it would be something they would live with forever. So I was, I think most of my fears were for them, maybe mostly just because of like the total narcissism of being a person where you just can't actually ever picture yourself dying. So I just all my worries were all the things that were out of my control.
Does being a practicing Christian help you if you are having these thoughts at 2 a.m.?
It's so weird, but Christianity fixes everything. I don't know if you know this, Phoebe, but it's a whole thing.
You never even wake up. You just sleep for 8 hours straight. And
yeah, and then your eyes open, and they're instead of retinas, it's just the shape of hearts. It's wildly convenient. I work at a divinity school, so it's just kind of full of do-gooders of all kinds. And a lot of that, part of it made life easier insofar as there are lots of things that they are good at that I really needed. I needed to be, have all the people show up with food and to have people who loved me enough to pray for me, which is to say, have hope for me when I wasn't sure how to have hope. And also, the Christian solutions to the problem of pain really felt like pretty pernicious, like truly terrible lies that people, like solutions that people were giving me, like, oh, but don't worry, heaven is going to be amazing, as if that would somehow diminish the tragedy of leaving behind a toddler, or, you know, that I would, heaven is great, you know, God needed an angel, God is closing doors and opening so many windows in the world that just need to be cracked open. And it was the Christian certainties that sometimes were much more painful to me than any other kind of like false hope.
Yeah, you just want to say to them, like, save it, you know, when they're...
Exactly. It's like they're kind of like God's hype man, just sort of like wants to sat alongside and be like, he's great. And I'm like, well, what I know of God's goodness is not showing up in this version. Thank you.
Support for This Is Love comes from Shopify. If you've ever had a dream of starting your own business, Shopify can be a great place to start. Shopify is an online platform that lets you sell things online and in person and makes it incredibly easy to accept all kinds of different payment methods, figure out how to charge taxes, how to charge shipping, and get detailed top-down views on how your sales are going. Some of your favorite brands already rely on Shopify to power their online shops, like Rothy's, Brooklinen, and Allbirds. But you don't need to be well-established to use Shopify. They'll help you at every stage of your business and have tools to help people who are just starting out, like their AI-powered tool, Shopify Magic, or their built-in marketing tools that can help you create and analyze campaigns. Shopify grows with your business, no matter how far or big you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/thisislove, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/thisislove now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/thisislove. Support for This Is Love comes from Quince. Lately, I've been less interested in having a lot of clothes and more interested in having fewer things that are well-made and will last me a long time. Quince offers well-made clothing like corduroy pants, 100% organic cotton fisherman crew sweaters, and really beautiful cashmere at a more reasonable price. Quince's items cost 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They partner directly with top factories and, according to Quince, only work with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. One of the things I got was a denim button-down shirt that has hundreds of great reviews. It comes in denim and chambray, feels very soft, and looks great. I also ordered their best-selling cashmere trouser sock in a few colors and even gave a pair to my mother. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/thisislove for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/thisislove to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/thisislove. Kate Bowler was given three paths that her body and her cancer might take. The first was that she could go through chemotherapy, which would hopefully give her some time. The second was that the cancer could proliferate so quickly that no treatment would be effective. It would spread too fast. The third, and the least likely, was that she could be eligible for an experimental immunotherapy treatment that some people were responding to. In order to qualify, she would need to have a certain variation of the cancer. She calls it the magic type of cancer. Only 3% of people with Kate's diagnosis have it. And it turns out she was one of them.
And so when I found out I was part of the 3%, I had that sort of feeling where I felt a little sick, like not being sure whether I could be hopeful or not. But everyone that loved me was just deliriously hopeful. And I sort of set my mind to being, at least outwardly, as hopeful as they were.
Kate Bowler enrolled in a medical trial at Emory University in Atlanta and began making the weekly trip from North Carolina, leaving her house for an early morning flight every Wednesday, spending the day getting treatments at Emory, and then returning home, arriving after midnight. The weekly trips lasted 9 months. Every 2 months, she was told whether she would qualify for another dose of the drug. She says she lived her life in 60-day increments. In February of 2016, a few months after her diagnosis, Kate Bowler published an op-ed in the New York Times titled "Death, the Prosperity Gospel, and Me." She writes, "I am a historian of the American prosperity gospel. Put simply, the prosperity gospel is the belief that God grants health and wealth to those with the right kind of faith." She spent more than 10 years meeting with pastors and congregants, asking them about their belief in the prosperity gospel.
They were looking for a spiritual universe to live in that felt fair, that if they had a certain kind of faith, that they could, if they spoke positively and believed positively, that they could finally find a solution to suffering and to disease and to poverty and to all the things, the uncertainties that plague us all. So once I began to see the world from that perspective, it became hard to unsee. That isn't that really sort of the quest that many of us have, which is how do I find a formula to get through life?
And to escape some of the worst.
Yeah. Yeah.
She writes that the modern prosperity gospel, quote, offers people a guarantee. Follow these rules and God will reward you, heal you, restore you. And she describes a time when a neighbor walked up to her husband and said, "Everything happens for a reason." Her husband said, "I'd love to hear it." One of the most endearing and saddest things about being sick, she writes, is watching people's attempts to make sense of your problem.
The chronic nature of what I had really lent itself to people wanting to openly explain why I was suffering. Was it something I ate? Was it something I did spiritually? Was it, like, who's at fault here? How do we, you know? And I think the pain of that, of feeling like I was a problem to be solved, was really the reason why I started writing, is I felt totally unable in my regular life to just say, sometimes pain is for nothing at all, or maybe everything doesn't happen for a reason.
That must be so refreshing. You know, for someone in your position, someone who is suffering from a serious cancer diagnosis, to read that, no, everything doesn't happen for a reason. I mean, I can imagine, like, for me, that's a refreshing idea. And so I can only imagine that for someone who was struggling, like you had been struggling, to see someone write that, stop telling me that, you know, just, you know, knock it off. It doesn't always happen for a reason. Things can be bad. There can be no explanation.
Yeah. I guess that was kind of the, I wrote it out of a deep place of loneliness. And then what I got back was really the first community that I'd been, well, that has sustained me to this day, really. I got hundreds and hundreds and then thousands of responses. That to me made me realize, like, this is a big community of people who want to say that there is truth and beauty and meaning in life, but there doesn't always have to be solutions and answers in the same way that we've been told.
Kate Bowler went on to write a book. She titled it, Everything Happens for a Reason and Other Lies I've Loved. In it, she writes, I can't reconcile the way that the world is jolted by events that are wonderful and terrible, the gorgeous and the tragic, except that I am beginning to believe that these opposites do not cancel each other out. Joy persists somehow, and I soak it in. Where are you in your journey with this disease right now?
Yeah, it's such a it's like such a complicated thing because I had like a series of surgeries that were for the most part really successful, and so I likely don't have much cancer left, but I keep having worrisome scans. So I guess it just, I've kind of treated it like I'm on the sort of bumpy service road of health. Like there's a health superhighway nearby and I can see all the traffic, but I'm just not there. So I just think of cancer as a chronic condition, and that I'm always, I'm very grateful not to be kind of the sort of Smokey the Bear threat level red, but I'm never going to be green again.
Do you ever speak with people who've just been diagnosed with stage 4 cancer? I mean, I'm sure you do.
Yeah.
Or people who reach out to you who are also kind of desperate for someone to not just say it's all going to be okay or whatever they're going to say. What do you say to them?
I guess maybe the thing that always feels most obvious is just saying the thing that I wish someone had said right away, which is that I'm so sorry this is happening to you. It's so unfair. No one ever apologizes for how unfair life can be, and I just am so grateful to be the person who can say that it is, that I'm so sorry this is happening to you. Just like acknowledgement. I felt like everyone was so quick to explain. What I really wanted was just to have the landing, the soft landing for a second. And and then to just and mostly why people reach out is that some kind of cultural script, like optimism or, you know, everything's going to be okay or everything happens for a reason kind of thing, is like standing as a barrier of inflexible optimism between them and people who love them, and that they just need a minute to feel the weight of the loss before they're ready to rally in any way.
This is because I don't believe that we necessarily, when we confront our own death or have seen the other side or live with this fear every day of bad news, that somehow makes us wise or sage or something. I don't think that. I think that
no.
You know, but what does it teach you about anything? You know, it doesn't have to be about. But what does it do? And it might not be a good thing that it does, but what does this do to you, and what has it done?
Yeah. I mean, it's I don't think I understood like precarity, like the being delicate, having my life built on things that are so contingent and could be taken away, and that maybe precarity is not something we can ever really get over. Maybe it's something we have to learn how to live beautifully inside. And I did not have that, you know, because my life had been relatively durable before and predictable. And I think precarity feels like it's a world I live in now. And what I love about it is that now I can see it everywhere. And it helps me kind of abandon some of the vanity of individualism and be like, oh my gosh, like we all belong to each other because we have to.
Does joy look differently to you now?
I think I did picture it like the kind of positive thinking, obsessive optimism, like it was the result of a lot of happiness. But now I don't know. I think it was my friend Nadia who said it. She was like, pain can scoop out of you, like carve out of you spaces that joy can then fill. I thought that was such a wise, like just a true thing to say, because I mean, this has been a long stretch of a lot of like sorrow. But weirdly, one of the only things that really cuts through all the noise is just usually surprising and ridiculous joy. And sometimes it's like, you know, like the doctor who makes a hilarious joke and lets you be himself, and then all of a sudden, you know, just, you know, laughing when you really should just be worrying about your surgical incisions. But like, and some of it is like a gingerbread party you throw for no reason. And some of it is just that you're so loved that you can't help it. So, yeah. I know joy isn't a solution, but it feels like the closest experience I have to like something that fundamentally feels like I'm experiencing enoughness.
Kate Bowler's most recent book is No Cure for Being Human and Other Truths I Need to Hear. This Is Love is created by Lauren Spohr and me. Nadia Wilson is our senior producer. Susanna Robertson is our producer. Audio mix by Rob Byers. You can find out more about the show at thisislovepodcast.com. We're on Facebook and Twitter at This Is Love Show. This Is Love is recorded in the studios of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. We're a part of the Vox Media Podcast Network. Discover more great shows at podcast.voxmedia.com. I'm Phoebe Judge, and this is Love.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art, Beats, and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu.
Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.